Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. I'm your host, Cedric Jungelman. In this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, I chat with Jesse Myers, a Bitcoin strategy advisor and the author of the mind-expanding essay, Once in a Species. Jesse shares deep excitement for Bitcoin treasury companies and how they might be the gateway for TradFi capital to enter Bitcoin at scale. We also dive deep into the evolutionary roots of money and how the innate human drive for scarcity laid the groundwork for the concept of money, civilization itself, and ultimately Bitcoin as the perfection of scarcity. If you're looking to understand what makes Bitcoin not just revolutionary, but species-defining, this conversation is for you. If you want to get in touch with me, it's Cedric at thebitcoinmatrix.com. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with my good friend Jesse Myers, a.k.a. Cretius.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Jesse Myers is a Bitcoin strategy advisor for UTXO, focused on implementing Bitcoin treasury strategy for UTXO portfolio companies, Smarter Web Company in the UK, Moon Inc. in Hong Kong, and as a member of the advisory board for LQWD in Canada. Previously, Jesse co-founded OnRamp Bitcoin, the pioneer of multi-institutional custody for Bitcoin, ran Protocol Capital, a Bitcoin hedge fund, and worked as a management consultant at Bain & Company. Jesse Myers has an MBA from Stanford and has been on this show twice already. One, and I think episode 121, We Are Still Early, Few. I think a classic on the show, if I may. And the second time in our first group therapy sessions with Vijay Boyapati. Welcome back to the show for the third time, Jesse. I'm so excited to have you here.
It's great to be back. Cedric, you do probably the best research of any podcaster in the space. So it's always like deep and interesting conversations.
I appreciate that.
No pressure, Cedric.
No pressure there, right? But I read your latest piece, Once in a Species, which is what I want to focus on tonight. You know, this has been 7 months in the works, though. I think we did run into each other on New Year's Eve at Michael Saylor's party. And we were talking socially, but you also said, I got this piece coming out. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to wrap up. I mean, just logistically, my schedule got crazy. I think yours got a little crazy. Fast forward, a conference came up in Vegas. You have a whole new career. But this piece is, you know, definitely stands the test of time. And here we are. It feels like 4 years have gone by, or like really two. You know, everything's like 4x in Bitcoin. But it's like 2 years have gone by, but it's only been 6 months. So it's great to see you again. I'm super excited to get into this. What inspired you to write this piece?
Yeah, great question. So I read Shelling Out, you know, when I was going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole in earnest, probably right after I read the Bitcoin Standard. So Shelling Out's from like 2002, Nick Szabo, and it's incredible. And I think it was definitive for me that, you know, this tells a story of how we got money as a species, and that shell bead jewelry is the early instantiation of money. It's proto-money, and it was used as proto-money because it had all these various social and economic benefits for someone who would had the foresight to carry some shell bead jewelry on them so that they could use it in a pinch, or, you know, to pass on wealth to their family members. And so Szabo does just a fantastic job of laying that out. In that piece, he leaves a few threads unexplored. He sort of hints that, you know, maybe this use of shell bead jewelry was part of our success as a species. And he doesn't really go any further down that incredible question. And actually on a podcast with Preston 4 years ago, we sort of dipped into that topic and talked a little bit about how shell bead jewelry might be our competitive advantage as a species. It might be what defines us as a species too. So that's been knocking around in my head for 4 or 5 years. And I knew that there was some research here I wanted to do to sort of update, you know, what's the current, you know, in terms of anthropology about shell bead jewelry, you know, 20 years after Szabo wrote that piece. And I finally had time. I finally made time to kind of do a few months of research and, you know, dug up all of Szabo's sources and read all that stuff, and then found what was current. And I was kind of blown away at the pieces that came together that I was then able to kind of pull together into this article, this essay, really, to make a case for why Shelby jewelry was our competitive advantage as a species, and how, you know, what happened in our evolution that brought about Shelby jewelry for us, whereas other early human species like Neanderthals didn't seem to have it.
Wow. Okay. So there's a lot to unpack there, but let's maybe jump into your background a little bit. I referenced that you have an MBA from Stanford. That's really important in terms of our first episode together and yuppies and way they don't maybe get Bitcoin. I recommend people go back and listen to that if you haven't already. But before your MS in accountancy, or at least that's my background, and before your sort of business studies, what did you study or look at before business?
Yeah. So my undergrad degree was in neuroscience. It was just really interesting to me. So I, you know, took a bunch of courses in that direction and found myself getting a, you know, majoring in neuroscience. And then I minored in business. And then because I couldn't get a business job with a neuroscience degree, I went and got a master's of accounting right afterwards. So that brought me into the business world.
Sure. So, and then maybe where does art fit into this and humanity?
That's cool you ask that. So my mom is an artist, and I think that's always been a part of, you know, my interest in human nature. And that's kind of how I start the piece off, because, you know, it is a commonly held view that art is what makes us human. You know, that we sort of have this romantic idea of like our species being better than, you know, different, special, because we have this spirit that drives us to engage in art. And so the intro for my piece here is to kind of walk back to the edges of art history. There's great examples of, you know, early figurines that are 30,000 years old, cave art of animals that are 30,000 years old. But the oldest cave art that we know of was recently dated in late 2024. It was dated to 66,000 years old. And it was a cave art hand, so a handprint, you know, etched in red ochre in a cave in Spain. That's the earliest known cave art. But there's a problem there, because our species didn't arrive in Europe for 20,000 years after that. So that handprint that you can go see the image of is a Neanderthal's hand. And I think that's such an interesting starting point of, you know, we talk about art as making us human, separating our species, but here is a Neanderthal engaged in early cave art 20,000 years before we showed up.
Right. And just to put that in perspective, like these figurines you're speaking to, of like you picked the Venus of Willendorf, a fertility goddess sculpture found in Austria that dates back to 30,000 BP, years before present. For perspective, that makes this statue 6 times older than the pyramids.
Yes.
And so 60,000 years old would be 10 times older, or 12 times older than the pyramids.
Yeah.
It's 3 times older than agriculture, the 30,000 year mark, and 5,000 years older than light skin.
Yeah.
This is...
There literally weren't white people when that figurine was made. That's how old that is.
Got it. And I guess, for example, these handprints that you, in Spain, they reach through time and proclaim, I was here and here I lived. Sort of a statement there, and I guess we recognize ourselves. So in the art, who are the Neanderthals then?
The Neanderthals are, you know, an early human subspecies. I like to call them a subspecies. The sort of recent trend in anthropology is to call them their own species. But in my book, a species can't interbreed with another species. I like that definition. And we interbred with Neanderthals. So I think it's a subspecies in my book.
Got it.
They colonized Europe hundreds of thousands of years before, you know, we did. Neanderthals branch off from the, you know, the Homo sapien lineage. I think it's like 450,000 years ago, which is about, you know, 150,000 years before modern humans, or 200,000 years before modern humans kind of finally crystallized in Africa. Ever since we discovered the first Neanderthal skeleton in 1856, there's been this question of like, you know, what are these things? You know, how do we describe them? How do we explain them? And it's always been, we jumped right to the idea that these were some brutes, some, you know, dumb cavemen that existed prior to modern sophisticated man. And that's kind of been the like cultural assumption about Neanderthals ever since. But as we learn more and more about Neanderthals, we've found that that's just not true. They seem to be pretty much identical to Homo sapiens sapiens, our subspecies, in terms of their behavior, their sophistication, their intelligence. And we can see that because of like the tools they use, the weapons they made. They're the same level of sophistication as our subspecies, you know, at the same time in history. And there's also, you know, a few examples of symbolic behavior, which is the fancy term that anthropologists love to describe art and also things like collecting collectibles. You know, we talked about the early cave art handprint on the wall. Neanderthals also seemed to occasionally collect special materials like quartz or fossils and some seashells. They also, there's a really fun little anecdote that is disputed of at a Neanderthal grave site. So they buried their dead. They've found that there's a bunch of flower pollen right above the graves. It either got there from natural reasons or they placed flowers on the graves of their dead, which is quite a beautiful, quite a human thing to have done. You know, so I think that kind of rounds out this picture of Neanderthals is actually not really any different from us. You know, they had slightly larger brain volumes even, and you were just as smart and just as human in these kind of essential ways about how they lived.
So that begs the question then. Well, I love the anecdote about the flowers on the grave and these human sort of things we do, kind of peculiar and interesting, but it begs the question, why us? Why did Homo sapiens sapiens, that's us, triumph over all other human subspecies?
Yeah, this is the eternal question, right? This is what we've been asking ever since we found Neanderthals is like, why did they go away and why did we, you know, win out? And, you know, the assumption has always been that we were more evolved or better, smarter, whatever. And yet all the things that we've learned about Neanderthals have sort of painted a different picture of they really weren't any different from us, except there's these two very notable differences that we do see in the archaeological record. One is that when Homo sapiens sapiens show up somewhere, they have a greater population density, about 10 times greater. And that's very peculiar. And I think it's something that Szabo noted in his piece and doesn't really explore. And the other big thing, which sticks out even more, is that as soon as Homo sapiens show up, there's suddenly a bunch of shell-bead jewelry in the sediment layers from those cave sites, which is to say that, you know, for some reason, Homo sapiens sapiens collected shell beads and turned them into jewelry and did this all over Africa and Europe and the Middle East, you know, whenever we showed up someplace. So this is over 100+ thousand years, you know, this was a consistent trend for us. And that doesn't match what Neanderthals were doing, which is very interesting. So, you know, Neanderthals weren't collecting shells and turning them into shell bead jewelry. And that's, you know, not explained. And it's an observation that Szabo makes and says maybe this was part of why we did better than Neanderthals, but he doesn't explore what could have driven that and really tie his work into, you know, what that would have meant for Homo sapiens sapiens as they encountered Neanderthals in the wild.
Sure. Then what was sort of the Victorian answer to all this when they discovered Neanderthals? And I didn't realize it was so recent in 1856, but what was sort of their impression to why Homo sapiens sapiens might have outlasted or sort of outcompeted the Neanderthals or just survived them?
Yeah, you know, I think their assumption was that this was some early, like, brutish, like, animal man, you know, and that they were stupid and unevolved. The early depictions of Neanderthals are, you know, a troglodyte kind of caveman that's sort of, you know, half chimpanzee really. And, you know, there's like a H.G. Wells sort of, I guess, just like a essay he wrote about, forget the adjective he uses. It's I think the ghastly man or something that's painted in quite a, and then he just lays into Neanderthals as some abomination that needed to be eradicated by the glorious and perfect Homo sapiens that, you know, eventually emerged. So, you know, from the get-go, there's just been this smearing of Neanderthals as kind of subhuman. And again, it turns out it's kind of not in line with the behavior and identity that we've managed to kind of piece together through the archaeological record over time about Neanderthals.
Sure. Then what about sort of current day or present day academia's impression of why we outlasted?
Oh, yes. Yeah, this part's funny. So the Shelby jewelry stuff in particular is quite interesting, because when Szabo wrote Shelling Out, the oldest example of Shelby jewelry that we had found dated to 75,000 years ago in South Africa. And over the last two decades, we've found a bunch more older examples. And the oldest now dates back to 142,000 years ago, and it's in Morocco. That doubles how long we've been engaged in proto-money and using Shelby jewelry as proto-money, as Szabo described, which makes it, you know, pretty incredible, as we'll get into, because that takes Shelby jewelry just about to the start of our species existence. And that's very important too. The archaeological study that discovered the 142,000-year-old Shelby jewelry, the co-author just has an incredible comment about speculating as to why early humans would have bothered to make Shelby jewelry. And he talks about how this was probably about identity, that individuals try to look good for strangers because you don't need to show who you are to your mother, but you do to strangers. Anthropology in general seems to completely miss and reject, I think, Szabo's very well articulated explanation of the economic benefits of Shelby jewelry as a proto-money. And instead, they choose to interpret, you know, these findings of, you know, this study just found the oldest money in human history, and they're describing it as cute little trinkets because, you know, early humans wanted to look good for strangers. Such a shame.
Or identified by their mother.
Yeah.
Which was weird. What about sort of the notion that maybe Homo sapiens outcompeted because we were just really great generalists?
Right. So the other funny thing I found about, you know, the modern interpretation of this question of, you know, why did Homo sapiens outcompete Neanderthals and other early humans? In 2018, a group of Oxford PhDs put out their new hypothesis as to why Homo sapiens outcompeted. And their conclusion was that our species is, quote, generalist specialists. And what they argue is that because we were able to inhabit every corner of the globe, that's proof that we were really good at thriving. It's a completely unsatisfying circular logic there of, you know, they're arguing that because we were good at living everywhere, that's why we did well.
Right.
And I think that just, you know, as I was doing my research, I just couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe that was the cutting edge explanation coming from anthropology as to why our species outcompeted other early human groups. Whereas, you know, Szabo had done a great job of laying out this possible key differentiator in terms of money, and then didn't explore exactly how those mechanics could have worked. So that's kind of when I knew I was onto something, that anthropology had was I think has succumbed to some sort of orthodoxy of identity and symbolic behavior, and trying to interpret all anthropology findings through the lens of like individual behavior, like individual feelings and identity. Which, you know, you can just sort of see how that has crept into academia everywhere. And I think that has blinded them to what I think is quite obvious, that human behavior is largely tied to economic action. You know, that you do things because it will benefit you economically. And economically here is a big umbrella term, but You know, every day you're making a decision about how you're going to allocate your time and energy based on what you think is economically worth it. And I think that that's very obvious here with Shelby Jewelry being present through over 100,000 years of human history and three continents.
Sure. So yeah, shell beads. But one thing you mentioned earlier is like we as Homo sapiens sapiens grew to kind of larger numbers.
Yes.
Collectively. What is the hidden economic purpose of shell bead jewelry?
Yeah, so this is what Zaba does a fantastic job of laying out, that he thought in terms of the Austrian economics school of thinking, and I think that's right, that in the whole study there, Austrian economics is all about understanding commodities as money, understanding how that works, how that, you know, naturally came about. Like obviously the primary focus is on gold as our kind of de facto commodity money through most of human history. But before gold, there were earlier commodities, and that makes sense from, you know, just the first principles point of view of like thinking through the logic of how this all works. And Menger laid out how a commodity becomes money in a group, and you start with it being a collectible. So, you know, if there's a commodity that a small subset of a social group value as a collectible, and then other members of that tribe or society start to recognize that there's a small group of weirdos that really, really value that commodity, then the rest of the tribe, if there's enough critical mass there, enough interest in that commodity from a small group, then the other members of the tribe recognize, okay, well, this has value because I can trade it with that small subset who really like this particular commodity. But that in making that logical leap, they grant this commodity what's called intersubjective value. And now that commodity has value because you know it has, you can trade it with somebody who values it. So now the whole social group actually values it because you know that it has a trade value to it. Now the commodity has graduated from a collectible to being a store of value asset. And then once it's a store of value asset, you can obviously settle trade in terms of that commodity. And now that's a medium of exchange. And then when everything's priced in terms of that commodity, it's a unit of account for that society. So the Austrians did a great job of laying this out and explaining this, that this is the history of money, is commodity money, is free market money. And it emerges organically through humans just, you know, behaving, just living their lives in tribes and realizing that certain things have value and are hard to get more of. And then a money sort of organically emerges from that. And if you then look at Shelby Jewelry with that context, it's quite obvious that this is those same mechanics in action. And that's what I think anthropology is missing about Shelby Jewelry when it turns up in the archaeological record, because, you know, the prevailing belief about money is Keynesian. In nature. That's what we've all been taught in schools, that the government decides what money is and that free market money doesn't exist, even despite all the history of money. So I think that's the kind of big disconnect between anthropology and not being able to recognize Shelby Jewelry as money.
That was great. So then why do we value collectibles at all? Like, what is the brain science of appreciating scarcity?
This is where it gets really cool. This is where when I stumbled upon this piece, it kind of brought everything else together to turn this essay into something that is actually a little bit groundbreaking, or quite a bit groundbreaking potentially. And what I came across is there was a really cool study from 2022 from Annalene Pinson et al. And they showed how there is a genetic difference between Neanderthals and other early humans and chimpanzees and other apes and Homo sapiens sapiens. And that difference is a gene called TKTL1. And what actually happened there is a point mutation. So a single nucleotide changed an amino acid in a protein. And then, you know, the resulting mutated protein behaved slightly differently from the earlier human version. And what they were able to show in a lab is that protein, the mutated protein, what they called HTKTL1, human TKTL1, was much better at neurogenesis in a specific area of the brain. And of course, that's where my neuroscience background was like, holy shit, wait a second. Am I reading this right? Because it started to all click there. And that specific region is the supragranular layers of the frontal lobe of the neocortex. All that means is the very outermost portions of the front half of your brain. And that is where this mutated gene is much more effective at helping to develop new neurons, which is very interesting because, you know, when I did neuroscience, when I studied neuroscience, I remember from that these regions of the brain are known for their association cortices. It's just kind of the term for the wiring that is unusual in these parts of the brain. And what that wiring does is gather information from various domains in your brain and then synthesize that into an abstract thought. So these are the abstract thought centers of the brain. It's just on the very front surface level of your brain. And that seems to me to be exactly where the difference in symbolic behavior from Homo sapiens sapiens, you know, versus Neanderthals and other early humans comes from.
Does that mean we're wired? Like, are modern humans wired the same or differently as archaic humans?
Yeah, so that's where the fact, you know, I wanted to tee up the fact that the earliest known cave art is actually Neanderthal cave art, and that we also do have some evidence of Neanderthals collecting uncommon materials, because those are both symbolic behavior, and the you know, flowers on grave example is also symbolic behavior. Symbolic behavior is abstract thought turned into some sort of human behavior. And so all those examples show that Neanderthals were capable of symbolic thought, of abstract thought, and sometimes acted on it. But the fact that those examples are very uncommon, very rare in the Neanderthal archaeological record also speaks volumes, because they may have engaged in art, but uncommonly. They may have collected strange materials, but they didn't seem to turn them into much. You know, there's a few examples here and there, but for the most part, they didn't act on it. They weren't compulsively driven to turn these unusual materials into pieces of art in any way, whereas Homo sapiens sapiens were. So to me, what that says is, you know, Neanderthals and other earlier humans had some latent capacity for symbolic thought, for abstract thought. And that manifested as some, but limited, symbolic behavior. And then this gene mutation happens and it overdevelops the areas of the brain involved in abstract thought. I think it's something like triples the neurogenesis factor there. So that meant that you just have like a overdeveloped circuitry. Like, it evolutionarily was unnecessary. You didn't need that amount of abstract thought capacity, or so nature thought. And then this mutation happens, and suddenly this tribe in Africa has, you know, a compulsion to engage in symbolic behavior, art, and collecting seashells and other collectibles. And then that species takes over the world very quickly.
All right. So taking over the world very quickly, let's pick up there. What about population density and what did we see as we moved into Europe?
So yeah, we teed up how Neanderthals had, you know, 1/10 the population density that Homo sapiens sapiens eventually had when they took over a territory from a Neanderthal group or other early humans like Homo erectus. This is where an important other concept comes in of Dunbar's number. So this is also kind of comes from the neuroscience realm. And, you know, it's a, most people have heard of it. Dunbar's number is 150. And it's a pretty seminal finding from evolutionary biology, really, that, or, like, before it was even called that. In the early 90s, that Dunbar, Robin Dunbar, analyzed the neocortex volume of various primates, and then, you know, also what size social groups they tended to live in, and he plotted those on a graph, and he drew a linear regression through it, you know, and found that if you had the neocortex volume of a Homo sapiens sapiens, then you should live in a group of about 150 individuals. And lo and behold, that's what humanity has done for, you know, that's a very natural number for us as a species to gravitate towards, you know, from everything from fraternities and sororities and other social clubs, you know, to like military units and being 150. It's a very natural size for us. And the implication from Dunbar's findings was that, you know, that was what we could socially handle is to live with 150 other individuals. And he, you know, the next year he added he put out another paper to add language and social gossip as like an efficiency multiplier for how you can possibly live in a group of 150 individuals without having to spend half the day socializing. Because that's what you would expect based on how much time like monkeys have to spend in one-on-one interactions every day. If you extrapolate that out to 150 individuals, it would take half the day. But we don't do that. We gossip and we're able to maintain social relationships through that much more efficiently. But he doesn't address how we do manage to live in groups larger than 150. And that's the glaring omission in my book of his research. Really cool stuff, but doesn't answer this, like, okay, so how do we function beyond that? And that's where I think the concept of money comes back and is essential to explain that and then to explain our population density advantage versus Neanderthals or other early human groups.
So maybe we'll tackle the money first as a sort of an efficiency multiplier, and maybe how that kind of, how does the concept of money, you know, sort of aid the economy or the sort of bring us more counterparties, yeah. I guess.
So if you think about like a pre-money civilization, you're existing in kind of a barter trade format within a tribe, and you don't have a money, and so you're engaged in, you know, favors and giving and taking, credits and debits between individuals in a tribe. And because there's no like monetary standard, you don't really know what the score is for each, you know, pair of people in that group. And so it's hard to keep track of. And in fact, the best way for this to be kept track of is for the social group to help police it. So that means that for every counterparty pair in a you know social group, everyone else needs to roughly know who owes what to who, and keep track of that, and then help police that in the event that you know there's a dispute of you know somebody forgets something or whatnot. So the way that order is maintained is that the rest of the social group has a consensus about, you know, this person owes that to this person. And that's how you maintain, like, you know, social order. And that inherently can only happen in a closed group. So to me, that is a big part of explaining the tribal existence, the natural Dunbar's number of 150. And I go so far as to say that maybe that is actually what Dunbar's number captures, is that our brains can only keep track of 150 individuals worth of counterparty interactions, because combinatorially that amounts to, I forget the exact number, like 11,000 counterparty pairs or something like that.
11,175.
There it is. Yeah. And so that's what the social group does there, is help police all that and roughly know who owes what to who. You know, you're not going to know exactly every detail, but beyond that number of 150 people, it becomes impossible to keep track of who owes what to who, because that grows exponentially. And so that puts a natural ceiling on, this is how large of a group you can live in while maintaining social order, through relying on the social group to police who owes what to who. And so that's a tribal existence, and that dictates that you can't really interact with other tribes, because you don't have a constructive transactional medium to engage in trade with. You can't apply the same sort of pre-money dynamic paradigm to doing trade with a stranger, because you know, there is no monetary unit to settle things in. And so, and the social group can't possibly help enforce with a stranger. So you end up avoiding strangers. You can't interact with other social groups, with other tribes. So you are stuck in a tribal existence just within your tribe. And that's where the population density comes in, because if you think about this sort of tribal existence before money, you inherently would have a default antagonistic relationship with other tribes, because there's not really any benefits in interacting with them. There's, you know, you could manage some barter trade, but you would also have violence, you know, with neighboring tribes, and you would be afraid of them. And so you would avoid them. You know, you would have blood feuds that you wouldn't be able to end, because they killed your uncle 10 years ago, and you know, you demonize them, and they are the out group, and you know, your tribe is the good group. And so you want to avoid them. You want to stay far away from them. So in that way, you know, you take the example of Neanderthals in Europe. A Neanderthal tribe would live in a valley, and they wouldn't go to the neighboring valley. They would stick to their valley because there's another tribe over there, and you want a nice big buffer between you and them. Fast forward to Homo sapiens sapiens, when they came into that area, suddenly they're supporting 10 times as many people in the same area. There's several tribes living in the same valley. Because there's more than 150 people living in one valley. And how is that possible? What makes that possible? And it's the concept of money that has made that possible. Because if you walk through the logic there, if you have, as a species, if you have the concept of money, shell bead jewelry, as something valuable, something that you can trade in, it also means that you have something to settle disputes with neighboring groups with, and to maintain alliances and truces with. And so suddenly you go from, you know, the only language that you have for interacting with another group is violence. You go from that to now you have this constructive transactional medium of money that you can use to, you know, maintain a healthy relationship with a neighboring group, and then benefit from trade with them, and also benefit through mutual security alliances. Right? Like if you're paying tribute to the powerful tribe next door, and in exchange they help keep you safe, that's great. That works out for everybody. Yeah, you're going to be the little fish in that dynamic, but like you're going to be a stronger unit, and you're going to survive because of that that arrangement. And so you're going to geographically gravitate towards each other because there's now benefit for you to stay close to each other. And there you've got the formula for greater population density, 10 times the population density. And then if you imagine the dynamic between your, you know, multi-tribe social group coming into the area that's controlled by a single tribe of Neanderthals, you're going to overpower them. Even if there's no violence involved, you're going to outcompete them for resources, and you're going to take over.
That's really fascinating. The way it gives the group the ability to grow within the group beyond the 150. And then, yeah, just by mere existence, they're either going to overpower by taking the resources, paying tribute and forming a mutual alliance, or just being outpowering because of the manpower factor. And it makes me think about how, like, obviously fiat is an evolutionary engineering incremental advantage over gold in a lot of ways in terms of speed and transaction efficiency. But it tribalizes us. It's very primitive in the sense that, you know, you have these sort of like the dollar tribe, the yen tribe. And I think what's even more remarkable about that, especially when you go into other economies, you have the intersubjective value problem of like they value their money more than we value ours, or vice versa. So then you get into sort of like exchange rates. And it's hard to like, I don't know if I want their money. But then you also get the situation where vendors say to themselves, there's a local price, there's the price for the countries I like, and then there's a price for the countries I don't like, you know, and then probably a price for the countries I haven't heard of. But, you know, you get all these different kind of like markets, you know, or sort of tribal prices. But I want to read a little bit from your piece.
Yeah.
To just outline what you went over. An additional efficiency multiplier neatly resolves this conundrum around, you know, Dunbar's number. So in a barter system of goods and favors, a social group can only reach 150 individuals before the number of interpersonal relationships becomes too numerous to keep track of, a la the 11,175 relationships based on the combinatorial math. At this point, the individual ledgers of personal debts between counterparties become impossible for the rest of the group to help police. In other words, a society without money can only function if it stays limited to Dunbar's number of 150 people, a tribal existence. Note that within this moneyless paradigm, intertribal relations would be generally antagonistic, with the benefits of barter overshadowed by unending grudges and blood feuds devoid of a mutually agreeable means of peacemaking between tribes. By contrast, if you have the concept of money, you not only are freed from the constraint of interacting chiefly within a closed group of 150, but you also gain the necessary transactional medium for constructive intertribal relations. Equipped with money, tribes can more easily engage in trade, as well as negotiate and maintain mutual security alliances. In turn, these benefits mutually foster the development of super tribal groups living in close proximity, thereby achieving 10x the population density of other early human subspecies. The coordination of such large multi-tribe populations would constitute a clear advantage when competing for resources against solitary tribal units of Neanderthals or any other archaic human species. Ultimately, this means that having the concept of money was the essential differentiator that allowed our subspecies to proliferate. And as we've explored, it's also the key ingredient that enabled large-scale population coordination to develop. Therefore, appreciating money is the foundational building block of human civilization and consequently of human flourishing. It turns out that it's not art that makes us human. Instead, our fascination with scarce assets is what makes us human. What are the lessons of the past that we can apply to the future then?
Yeah, this is, you know, obviously if you're a Bitcoiner listening to all this, you're thinking, okay, this is interesting, but it's obviously by then taking this lesson and looking forward that you get probably the biggest value out of considering this history. And this is where, you know, Bitcoin is the, you know, if it's true that valuing scarce assets like shell bead jewelry because of this overdeveloped circuitry in our brain that causes us to have an abundance of abstract thought, if that's, you know, what differentiates us, and then valuing seashells and other collectibles is what gave us the concept of money that caused us to have a competitive advantage as a species, then, you know, the quest for the best scarce asset as a money is intrinsically part of who we are as humans. It's in our DNA. It's part of our species to seek that out. It's been our competitive advantage for the entirety of our species, and it's still in us now. And we've been looking for the perfection of scarcity by going from seashells to then eventually finding gold. Oh, gold's actually scarcer than seashells. I can store my value in it better than I can trust seashells to store my value. And now Bitcoin is the perfection of scarcity. And Bitcoin is the fulfillment of our species-long quest for scarcity.
So is this what defines our species? Perfect money?
It's not that, yeah, my view here is that it's not that perfect money defines us. It's that the quest for it, the desire for it, valuing scarcity is what defines us as and differentiates us, sets us apart as a species. And that therefore, having something come along that is the perfect version of what we've been looking for is inevitable, that our every member of our species has this circuitry, this wiring, this DNA-driven wiring to value things that are hard to make more of and to covet things that are valued by others. And then here is this thing that is the perfect instantiation of those attributes. And it's, you know, no surprise then that every member of our species, as they learn about Bitcoin in their own ways and in their own time, finds a gravitational pull towards it, that they want some of it and they want to store their value in it because it's better than anything else.
So how often does this happen? Like every Sunday or?
Well, this is a once in a species event. Because you can only have the fulfillment of perfect scarcity one time, and Bitcoin is it. And this is what we've been, you know, searching for as a species for over 142,000 years since, you know, the earliest proto-money seashell bead jewelry. And now we finally, it was never possible in the physical realm to create perfect scarcity, because with every other asset you can make more of it. You can mine more gold. There's always more gold in the ground, in seawater, and in asteroids. There's always more gold. there's even more land too. You can dredge swamps, you can clear cut forests, and you can build into the sky. But Bitcoin, because it's in the digital realm, it was possible to set rules around it that made it impossible to make anything more, any more of it. Not true of anything in the physical realm, but it's possible in the digital realm. And then Bitcoin was the invention of digital scarcity. It, the first time that that was manifested in a viable way. And that moment is very special because it's the invention of digital scarcity. It's also the invention of absolute scarcity, because there's a finite cap on this particular design. And it also implemented increasing scarcity in a way that no other asset has, which I think is a big part of why it grows in value over time. So none of this was possible in the physical realm. It needed the internet to exist before it was possible. And we just happened to be living in a time where the internet now exists, and then enough time passed for someone to come up with Bitcoin and take the properties that are possible in the digital realm and turn them into a viable system of perfect scarcity. And now we are living through what follows, which is everyone in our species having to come to grips with and wrap their head around and adapt their behavior to. Now there's a perfect form of scarcity in the world, a perfect money.
I'm blown away. Let me read a little bit more. While Neanderthals and other archaic humans had the basic brain circuitry necessary for abstract thinking, this latent capacity was evidently insufficient. A certain threshold of covetous interest in scarce collectibles is necessary to bootstrap the concept of money in a social group. Neanderthals and other archaic humans lacked the brain circuitry to achieve this critical mass. And herein lies the answer to our question. The reason that Homo sapiens sapiens outcompeted all our human subspecies is that we are wired differently. And as a result, we have an exaggerated capacity to appreciate and value commodities that are hard to come by. In other words, we are wired to cherish and covet scarce collectibles like seashells. You know, I think about like myself, like my dad was a collector his whole life of basically anything. You start with baseball cards and then you go from there. It's coins, it's stamps, you develop an inner subjective ability. You develop an ability to calculate inner subjective value in a certain area. So you become a baseball card expert or whatever. And I grew up watching baseball at his knee and collecting cards and learning from him about that. And you see it even with my daughter, and she's a pretty flower and she wants to, take it home and then sort of dry it out and display it. Or she makes a lot of art, and you just sort of so you see it evidently in our behavior. And I want to read, a little bit more from the piece before I have my final question for you. So inevitably, we turn now to Bitcoin. The history of money and human civilization is characterized by an ongoing process of upgrading from one form of money to a fitter, more scarce form of money. This selective pressure of monetary Darwinism stretches back at least 142,000 years and likely much further in our 300,000-year history. With gold's emergence as a visible store value in the Danube Valley 6,000 years before we kind of have modern history, the modern history of money has been characterized by the conquest of gold over all of the monetary local optimums around the world, specifically because of its unmatched physical scarcity. But with the dawn of the digital age, it became possible to create a commodity more scarce than gold. Bitcoin was deliberately designed to solve for gold's weaknesses and to improve on gold's strengths. Most importantly, Bitcoin perfected scarcity. For the first time in human history, there is a form of money with immutably finite supply, the invention or discovery of absolute scarcity. If you put Bitcoin in the long timeline of human history, it is the perfection of our species' defining fascination, scarce assets. Just 16 years into its existence, we are witnessing the ongoing and inescapable gravitation of all Homo sapiens sapiens to this perfection of store value scarcity. We can't help it. It's quite literally in our DNA to appreciate and value scarcity. With this context, it's no wonder that people who learn about Bitcoin become insufferably zealous about it. This is what we've been searching for over 142,000 years. Valuing scarcity is what differentiates us as a species, what makes us human, which means that absolute scarcity is the ultimate fulfillment of our species' long quest for better scarcity. After 12,000 generations of mankind, somehow we are lucky enough to be alive during this monetary transition to perfect scarcity. This only happens once in a species. Brilliant piece, Jesse. So, you know, they say Bitcoin, you know, changes you. You know, how did Bitcoin changes you? And this is a once in a species event. Does Bitcoin change our species? Does it change us as humans, as a group?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you can reach that conclusion just by thinking through that it changes each of us as we come to understand it. You know, changes your how you approach saving. You know, how you value your time. How you discount. The benefit of spending now versus saving for the future, all those calculations shift. You know, inevitably Bitcoiners become stingier. They start to save more because it shifts the economic calculus of spending today versus saving for the future, saving for your future and also for your children's future. I mean, it's pretty dizzying when you think about it on those timescales. And you know, what is our civilization if not the aggregation of individual interests that sum up, and individual behavior that sums up to society level norms and outcomes. An example that I love is thinking about inflation versus deflation. You know, for 150 years or so after the American Revolution, the U.S. existed on the gold standard before the invention of central banking. And that, you know, the tail end of that is known as the Gilded Age. And it's also, synonymous with craftsmanship. There's an incredible, you know, for hundreds of years before that too, a flywheel of improving quality of crafts of trades, and the reason for that is if you're on a gold standard, it's effectively very slightly deflationary, because the economy grows faster than they mine gold, and so to keep your prices the same, you have to improve the quality of your goods, the quality of your service. So people got better at their job and they made their products better just to maintain the same prices. And the result of that was, you know, craftsman homes and, you know, beautiful public works that if you're ever in Paris and you walk across a bridge, pay attention to the lampposts. These were all built, 100 to 150 years ago, and they're incredibly ornate, beautiful works of art for a public lighting instrument, which obviously if you think about how that would be done today, it would be a stick in the sky that was the cheapest to make. And that's what our culture does with deflation, is it becomes a culture that values quality and a culture that where quality is the norm. And if you have the opposite, which we've had for the last 100 years, a monetary standard of inflation, the reverse flywheel happens where everything has to get worse if you want to keep your prices the same. Everything, you have to cut corners, you have shrinkflation, you make everything shittier just to keep your prices, to not hike them. And the result of that is what we see when we look around in our culture today. Everything sucks. All the products suck. Everything's worse than, in terms of build quality. You know, if you walk into a newly built home, you're not going to see an ornate banister as you might have with a Victorian home. And that's just, you know, a simple example of the cultural impact of a monetary standard. And that permeates everything in culture. So, you know, beyond architecture and craftsmanship, it impacts, you know, how we behave and our moral standards, and everything gets impacted by the money. And so if you go from a fiat-based inflationary monetary standard to a version of gold that's better than gold, it's more deflationary than gold, we're going to reap the benefits as a culture of returning to that flywheel of deflation and how that improves society over time. And that's, you know, that's what Bitcoiners end up discovering as they learn enough about Bitcoin, then they get really excited about the future, because the future looks bright when you know that your savings will grow in purchasing power over time. Everything looks better. And that optimism, yeah, permeates everything, and every Bitcoiner gains that optimism about the future, and simultaneously every person on the planet has this, I think, inevitable future of coming to Bitcoin and then themselves developing this optimism, because they will reap the benefits of the savings technology that grows in purchasing power over time.
Yeah, I love all of what you shared there. The only thing I would add to it, another way I look at it, is these protocols sort of add synergy, not just to the individual to be empowered, but for individuals to communicate and empower each other. So like the internet can put two people in touch around the world who never got to talk to each other and communicate and trade and exchange ideas. Bitcoin, and I think about it like the internet is sort of, hasn't reached full human adoption yet. It's probably like 70-80%. So there's still humanity that hasn't gotten the internet, and there would be more synergy from that. And then I don't like I love and I celebrate our differences, and I think there's a lot of beauty in our differences, but I love this idea of like the internet is bringing like one language to the planet, at least through commerce and the internet. And that tends to be English. I don't think it's the best language, but it seems to be what's, you know, and then so if we have one language on the internet and one money, then we can have a lot more synergy just by being able to connect and communicate with each other through the language of money. So yeah, so much to look forward to there. I love this piece. Just thinking about perfect scarcity, just like, you just see it, I guess, kind of saying before, we're always looking for it, just by nature.
Yeah, when I put this piece out, a bunch of people read it, like 40,000 people have read it, which is really cool. A lot of the comments were centered around like, you know, my daughter loves collecting seashells, you know, my 4-year-old or whatever. Or other examples like that of, you know, like you mentioned flowers, and that this sort of, it speaks to that. It's such a intimate part of what it is to be human, is like you end up coveting things that are rare. And maybe you value them because they're beautiful. Maybe it's just because they're so uncommon. I mean, like meteorites are not exactly beautiful. I guess they could be, depending on it, but they're extremely rare, right? And people value that. So there's, you know, it speaks to this just sort of reality that we all understand and hasn't been, I think, well articulated, certainly not by anthropology, unfortunately. Of like, why do we do that? Like, what is it about our behavior? Like, why do we care about seashells when we see a pretty seashell on the seashore? And the contrast, which is quite fun to think about, is, you know, since Neanderthal cave sites seem to not have many seashells in them, or collectibles in general, then, you know, you can conjure a mental image of Neanderthals that lived by the coast, walking down the seashore, and they would see the same shells that you see, and they wouldn't feel compelled to pick it up. And that you know, that's so alien to us. It's hard to fathom that. But that little behavioral difference, I think, ends up becoming this overwhelming competitive advantage that we have as a species, which is appreciating scarce assets, which leads to the development of the concept of money, And then the concept of money enables, you know, multi-tribal population coordination, which is, you know, the genesis of civilization. So it all is all downhill from this quirk that we all have of valuing pretty things that are rare.
Oh man, it's making my head explode. Spin out of control here. I think about, we go down to the beach all the time. We look for shark teeth.
There you go. Perfect.
You know, yeah, looking for, and it's the thrill of the find, but it's also getting the thing that's valuable and that others don't have. And I think about baseball cards still all the time. It's like you're trading like this shitty paper for shitty, you're trying to trade shittier paper for less shitty paper. Yeah. And then you think about the insiders in that game and baseball cards and the producers. And then, you know, the how do you, you know, verify the card is real? How do you, you know, how the card doesn't have an error? It hasn't been smudged. How do you secure it? It's not divisible. And then you have the whole, you know, when I was in Fiji, like backpacking through Fiji, I just remember, I don't remember if it was shark teeth or whale teeth, but the tribal chief always had the biggest shark tooth, you know, like on a necklace. And that signified, and I think the prime minister even had to have like the biggest shark tooth in all the islands, like, I don't remember. There's all that lore and use, and you could think about rye stones and all of it. So
yeah,
talking to you is always incredibly dope, Jesse. This is, you know, kind of blowing my brains here up, but some big brain stuff, but I love it. And I got to have you back on ASAP because we got to marry this and then explore the Bitcoin treasury company thing and what you're doing personally, but the whole scene. I mean, these are like two pillars. So I'd love to have you back soon.
Yeah, I would love that. We were talking before the show. I said that I think the two most interesting topics in the world to me right now, obviously I'm a little biased with this article, but is this article and this concept, and then Bitcoin treasury companies and what they mean for Bitcoin and the world from a capital markets perspective. So really excited to come back and talk all about that and what we're doing with Smarter Web in the UK. Which, yeah. You know, short answer is I think we're on a path to potentially repeat what Metaplanet has done in Japan over the last 15 months.
Very interesting. Well, we're definitely going to do that. We have to unpack all that as well. And I think you're the right person to do it. So people should go Google Once in a Species, go see it on your timeline on X. But please let people know where they can find you, Smarter Web Company, and your work.
Yeah. This article, just Google Once in a Species, the onceinaspecies.com also will take you right to it. A few years of thinking and writing distilled into a 14-minute read, which I think is a really fun ride. So if you found this an interesting conversation, you'll probably enjoy the article even more. You can find me on Twitter at @Croesus_BTC. And you can check out Smarter Web at smarterwebcompany.co.uk, or you can find our Twitter group, which I post in a fair bit. So you find my profile and then go see that Twitter group. It's all about, you know, that community kind of growing right now. And there's like 3,000 people in that group at the moment. And, you know, for a 3-month-old company, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, man, for sure. This has been always fun to talk and Jesse. Can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, look forward to it. Thank you, Cedric.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to like, subscribe, and drop a comment below with any questions or thoughts you may have. We'd love to hear from you. You can support the show by checking out our sponsors and affiliate links in the description. It helps keep bringing you great content while connecting you with awesome products that I believe in. Share this episode with your friends, family, or anyone curious about Bitcoin. And let's keep growing this community together. Stay curious, keep stacking, and I'll catch you in the next one.